Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Washington's unipolar moment ended years ago. Unfortunately and dangerously, the foreign policy blob has refused to come to grips with this new reality. This explains the increased tensions in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. And the biggest loser is the West. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He's a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And in Marrakesh, we cross to Martin Jay. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Glenn in Oslo. You and I were in contact before we started this recording, and you decided on the topic on the unipolar moment. Well, much to my surprise, Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, gave a big speech about dominance of the West is coming to an end. So what an interesting collision of perfect storms here. First of all, for our audience, what is meant by the unipolar moment, unipolarity? What does that mean?
Well, again, this I think this is a major story of our time, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, the world became unipolar. This means that there was only one center of power in the world, because during the Cold War, it was bipolar, you had two centers. Now, under the unipolar order, you only have one center, which is the United States, which organizes the West as a collective hegemony. So and so this really emerged then 30 years ago as the Soviet Union collapsed. And again, preserving the unipolar distribution of power became the foundation for U.S. security strategy. The idea was that as long as the U.S. maintained its global hegemony, then there would be no rivalries between the great powers. And this was therefore referred to as a unipolar peace, or a hegemonic peace, if you will. So the problem was what many academics pointed out, which was the unipolar moment would unavoidably be temporary, because first of all, it would exhaust U.S. resources to dominate the world. But second of all, because maintaining U.S. dominance would depend on preventing the rise of other centers of power, one would expect that countries as different as Russia, China, India, Brazil, and others would increasingly cooperate with each other to balance off the United States, because they see the United States trying to keep them down. Well, as we see now 30 years later, these predictions have come into fruition. That is, the U.S. have exhausted many of its resources, and the major powers are now cooperating to create alternative security and economic infrastructure, which is independent of the United States. And the question has always been, how would the U.S. respond? Even Brzezinski, if you remember, he was could not be more Russophobic, yet he also recognized there was a dilemma. The U.S. can either facilitate and support a transition to a multipolar order, where the U.S. has a privileged position, or alternatively, the U.S. can fight all its rivals in a grand standoff to regain its former dominant position. Now, I think that because the West has linked the survival of liberalism and our values to hegemony, there is no negotiation. So what we now see is that the U.S. is indeed pursuing confrontation with many, mainly Russia in Europe, China in Asia, and Iran in the Middle East. And so this is effectively what we're seeing, that is, the U.S. will fight to restore his global hegemony, even though this does not seem very likely at all.
Well, you bring up a really good point, Martin. I mean, one of the things that, you know, and Glenn gives a perfect explanation there, but is this an ideological thing? Is it based on security? Is it based on geopolitics? Because if it's ideological, then the West cannot lose. Well, that is everything, goes against everything in history. Empires rise and fall. Centers of power move around. I mean, that is the nature of geopolitics through all of time. And so the West seems, because of its ideology, that it is the end of history, as Fukuyama said. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, I think Tony Blair having a whine about some Western power waning is quite funny, isn't it? He must be down to his last $500 million. Poor guy. But to answer your question about ideology, I don't know if that's the right word. Is it an ideology? Is it a philosophy? It's the only model that the West had so long, was that these huge powers of elite, which controlled our politicians, you know, had a very singular view of the world, which the politicians followed. You know, they looked at poor countries and they said, are you poor and backward? Do you have a huge democratic deficit? You know, are you in debt? Do you need American aid? And will you fall on the ground and lick the boots of Uncle Sam? And if countries around the world said yes to all those five, then they were welcomed. There was a huge body slam. You know, you're our kind of guy. You're our kind of dictator, our kind of leader. This is how the Americans thought and the West followed with this doctrine. But I think a lot of it was about, you know, what we've got now is we're sore losers. This is the problem. We're losing our power and we don't really know how to deal with it. Just as the British Empire imploded at the end of the Second World War, you know, the Americans don't really know how to deal with this new scenario that China, Iran, Russia, India, these countries are really forming. They're really getting their act together and creating a real opposition to America. So, you know, how do we cope with that in the longer term? There's going to be casualties. There's going to be a lot of chest thumping and whining. But I don't think most of it is genuine. I think a lot of it is just the West not really coping very well with this new world order.
You know, it's interesting what Martin just said there, Glenn, because if we frame it in ideological terms, well, a lot of what the Western liberalism, and that's going a stretch, means today, well, first of all, it's very alien to most of the world, this wokeism stuff and all of that. I mean, most of the world scoffs at it as being just ridiculous. I mean, how do you build a coherent, prosperous society based on these ideas that the West is very forcefully exporting right now? And as a result, and what we've seen, the Global South not condemning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, I think you can draw two conclusions. One, they don't take the West very seriously anymore. And number two, and very importantly, they're not afraid of it anymore. Thoughts?
No, I agree. And I would add another thing. I think when the West keeps talking about that this is an attack on the rules-based order, this becomes a way of expressing, again, ideology as power. So they're saying, you know, without Western hegemony, you can't have the survival of, for example, liberalism. But I think the rest of the world, they're a bit critical because they see this mainly as the power lying behind. Because when the West, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, began to pursue this hegemonic liberal order, well, what it was defined as was giving essentially the West this prerogative to give itself an exemption from international law. So keep in mind when the West brings up these principles, the great principles, democracy, human rights, it's not used to limit the power of the state, rather it enables it. So for example, it promotes this concept of sovereign inequality in which you refer to democracy and human rights. The West can interfere in domestic affairs, it can topple governments by calling democratic revolutions, it's allowed to invade for calling it humanitarian interventions, even severing territories of other countries. So there is this sense that the liberalism has been so intertwined with the hegemonic concept when the West speak about the West's leadership, we see it as the guarantee for liberal values, but the rest of the world increasingly sees liberalism as simply being an ideological talking point to justify hegemony. So well, one can take both sides in this argument, but it is quite interesting that these discussions aren't really being held in the West at the moment, where the power of the West, the hegemon, is disappearing, and thus at the same time the world is increasingly rejecting this liberal ideology which will justify the hegemony.
Well, you know, Martin, you know, we under the current administration, the Biden administration, it's about democracy versus autocracy, a real throwback to the past in my opinion, with really no perspective on the realities on the ground around the world. But then, you know, Joe Biden, if he takes on board his democracy versus autocracy, he fist bumped the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. I mean, what is the world to make of this here? I mean, where's the human rights? Where is the democracy? Where's the rules-based order? I mean, it's just absurd. And the whole world sees this, okay?
That's the problem. Yeah, Glenn touched on the point. He said that these incredibly seismic issues, these qualities that we cling on to, have done since the best part of the last 70 years, are really just talking points. That's absolutely correct to use that phrase. They are, and the whole world has realized this. You know, before, perhaps, if you go back, let's say only 15 or 20 years, you know, when the West made huge decisions, it could bank on a fair amount of its ex-colonies in the Global South to support the UN, to support these. Those days are gone. You know, now the West, the so-called West, what is the West? The West is the EU, 26 countries, and America and Canada. What is the West? What can it do now in with these huge subjects? It's very much on its own. And it has to keep on banging this drum and going on about these liberal values. But the truth is, we don't even believe in those liberal values ourselves anymore. You know, democracy, free speech, human rights. Just look at what we're doing to our own people. Look at the Julian Assange case. You know, look at the number of journalists that are being arrested in Europe for reporting on the war in Ukraine, but reporting not the way.
The January 6th rioters.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, this edge that we had is gone. You know, we're looking at a new reset, a new world order. And China and Russia are actually beginning to make it very clear to the whole world that there is an alternative out there. You know, and I think the longer that we go on, though, with these ideas, the more that the West is exposed of being more corrupt than it ever was. You know, corruption is now really a huge factor. Now, when we look at Ukraine, when we look at China, I mean, how can you mention China without Biden family relations with deals that are going on there? How can you talk about Ukraine without looking at what Biden's family are doing in the Ukraine? It's disgusting. And the only way that we read about these articles, we read about this graft, is from foreign journalists, from the other side of this new world order, from the China, from Russia, from Turkey, from wherever. You know, our journalists have just, you know, forgotten how to do their job. And it's, so we are shaping up to something completely new. We don't really know what it's going to look like, but we are living in a new reality that, you know, America and its allies in Europe are no longer a dominant force anymore. They're going to have to take a back seat to a new economy, a new set of rules. And we're not behaving really very well about it with our attitude towards China, which shocks me, actually, that there's so much belligerency. There's so much chest beating and talkings of war. How do you go to war with one of your greatest trading partners? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but Glenn, but you know, Martin brings up a great point here, and it goes back to my original question here, is that this is just ideologically driven. It's not rationally, this is not assessing your assets and your strength and your ability to get what you want. I mean, these rose-tinted glasses, it's self-limiting, and it's actually self-humiliating. Go ahead, Glenn, 30 seconds before we go to the break.
No, I agree. And I think a good example of this is exactly the China issue, because our problems with China could easily be resolved. A lot of this goes back to the One China policy. Like, China's been very open. It will not intervene in Taiwan unless the U.S. steps over the line and recognizes independence. So what has the U.S. been doing? Gradually abandoning the One China policy, which then sparks Chinese intervention. And based on this, we're now making China an enemy because it's predictably responding to a provocation as we had already expected. So it's just...
It's no different than NATO expansion. A provocation, and then you get a reaction. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with us. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Martin and Marrakesh. One of the interesting things about this unipolar moment coming to an end, it has come to an end. And well, one of the big differences in looking at European politics and the crisis in Ukraine is that it seems to me that Germany has finally completely abandoned Ostpolitik of Willy Brandt. The current government in Germany no longer I think it was Willy Brandt talked about two different legs, one be able to stand on, stay in the West, but be able at the same time to reach out to the East. It seems like those days are over. And that is one of the accomplishments of Washington and London. I mean, to finally break the relationship that Putin wanted since he came to power of having a good, vibrant relationship with Germany. That seems to have come to an end. And I would say as a result, it has isolated Europe because there's not a major power in Europe now that wants to reach out and have some kind of detente. We haven't used that word in a long time with Russia. Go ahead, Martin.
No, I think we're a long way from a detente, unfortunately, because when you get into the heads of some of these Western elites who still believe they can play the war of attrition with Russia, you see that they're not interested in any long-term friendship or deal with Russia. You know, we liked Russia during Yeltsin's period because it was poor and backward and nothing seemed to work. And they needed the help of America at a certain point. There was a little tiny window where Yeltsin seemed to be our guy. You know, as soon as Putin came in and started to build the economy, suddenly we don't like Russia anymore. Russia's a problem. Russia's a threat. Russia's creating all these problems for us, you know. And what comes from that, what I noticed as a journalist, is this packaged fear-mongering, which is delivered through the media. You know, we've got all this fear-mongering going on now. Fear-mongering is nothing new in the West. We've been doing it. You know, you can go back to the days when Rumsfeld was a young man and Nixon went to Russia, the Soviet Union in 1962 and came back with a so-called deal. Rumsfeld and Cheney were looking at him and saying, no, we've got these new Russian submarines, which are non-acoustic. There's hundreds of them just, you know, parked off the coast of America, you know, and they couldn't get it into their heads that because we couldn't detect the Russian submarines, the new submarines, that doesn't mean that they're not there. In reality, they didn't exist. They weren't there, but it didn't
threat
stop.
Inflation. It's always threat inflation.
Yeah, the power of nightmares, the power of fear-mongering, hugely powerful, didn't stop the next administration, the Ford administration, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, in investing in today's terms, billions of dollars in more military-industrial complex kit to try and detect these so-called non-acoustic Russian submarines, which didn't exist. The same thing's going on today. We've got more fear-mongering over China. I know where it's heading. It's heading towards more military spending. That's the number one thing. And we've seen it in Ukraine. And I'm beginning to wonder, you know, as a skeptical journalist that's covered graft for the best part of over 30 years, I'm beginning to wonder whether big international mafia-style corruption is taking over here. Are these elites who we elected as so-called democratic leaders of our values, of our beliefs in this neoliberalism, are they actually pocketing huge amounts of money from these arms deals? We don't know where these arms go. We don't even see the receipts from Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. You know, we don't even know if they get delivered. You know, if you're as old as I am, you can probably remember Reagan coming into power and the arms scandal with the Contras. You know, Reagan used the fog of war to cover up all this secrecy, to create secrecy over basically selling arms to the Iranians, which is illegal, taking $30 million off Iran and taking $18 million of that and giving it to the Contras to fight the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, all of course completely illegal. He got off the hook. He was never nailed for that because he used the fog of war to actually move dirty money around. You know, people in the West are very, very naive. They don't understand.
The people that did take the fall for it were pardoned. Okay.
Yes. So well, everybody became the president of the NRA in the end. So he got quite a good job out of it.
Well, also, I mean, I hate invoking Tony Blair's name again. Sorry, but I mean, talk about the dominance of the West coming to an end. I mean, he was part of the tipping point. He was very much with the agreeing to the illegal war in Iraq.
But the point is, Peter. What I'm saying is that the point about Ukraine and the point about Iraq and the point about Afghanistan is dirty money. Dirty money is all about these games. You know, how do you move money around? How do you store dirty money? How do you save dirty money? How do you cream dirty money off huge arms contracts? Assange said pretty much the same thing about Afghanistan. He said the point of Afghanistan was not to finish a war, win a war. It was to create a sort of black zone where you could keep a lot of dirty money and keep everybody in check. You know, when I was in Afghanistan in 2017, I hung out with British soldiers, and one of the biggest frustrations they had was they would show me their head cam video of while they were fighting Taliban on one side of the field, other people were collecting heroin, morphine on the other side and packing it away. And you know, so there was a lot of corruption there. And I think all I see in Ukraine now is dirty money. I see dirty money in China. You know, who's getting this money? Who is actually profiteering? Going back to the Ronald Reagan-Iran-Contra affairs, we still don't know today how those American arms companies got paid the $30 million. How did they get paid?
Well, I think that we'll end up calling it the Hunter Biden model, okay? Glenn, you know, going back to the big picture here of the end of the unipolar moment, I mean, are we in a Thucydides trap right now? I mean, because I think we're all in agreement. It's a combination of ideological possession and greed, okay? I mean, Afghanistan was a grift. I mean, it wasn't to win, it was to keep it going. That was the whole thing, is just to keep it going. It looks like that's something they may try in Ukraine. I don't think that they're going to be nearly as successful. That's why I think they're pumping so much money in there. They can pump it now while you can, okay? And there'll be no accounting for it later, just like in Afghanistan. So Glenn, I mean, are we in a trap right now? Is the West going to have to maintain its ideological predominance because it's messianic? Be turned to force, because everything's about loss of face. They've created a situation where either you win completely or you lose completely. But world history is everything's in the middle. It doesn't usually get to the extremes. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, and I agree, but it also depends how one would define the objectives. I mean, if you look at Ukraine and Russia, they were actually moving towards, their diplomacy were moving forward towards a peace agreement, as we know, in March. And again, what's not disputed is that the Ukrainians walked away from it because the United States and the UK pressured them to do so, arguing that, you know, you can win on the battlefield. We'll give you all the weapons you need. Of course, no one thinks today that Ukraine can defeat Russia, but still, the strategy is give Ukraine as much weapons as they need. But what the weapons need for what? If they can't defeat Russia, it's, again, simply to continue this going. And again, from the U.S. Congress and all and the media, you keep hearing this idea over and over again that, you know, this is an opportunity as well to bleed Russia dry of its economic and military power. So I think this idea of dragging out the war is part of the goal, and it's also good for alliance building because what the United States as a key military power, a lot of its influence comes exactly from having these enduring conflicts. I mean, the United States has been trying to get the economic and political influence over the EU for years. And only now, with this war ongoing, are the Europeans, you know, bending over and effectively doing what the Americans want them to. And I think you can also see the same possibly in Asia. If military conflict begins to intensify or escalate, so pressure around with China, maybe it can mobilize some of the neighbors of China with the United States. And obviously, the reason I'm saying it's because you're seeing this now in the Middle East as well. This agreement now, which Biden made in Israel and then going to Saudi Arabia, this is to build up the rhetoric against Iran. Now, why would the United States do this? Well, obviously, this can open up for an Israeli attack on Iran. However, it could also be simply to shore up U.S. leadership and influence in the Middle East. By having this conflict there, they have to look towards the U.S. for leadership, and that's the source of influence in the region. So again, I'm not sure what else the explanation could be, because pursuing a conflict against Russia and Europe, China and Asia, and Iran now in the Middle East, a major war there, you can't possibly fight on three fronts. So I think this having this slow burning conflict might be a strategic objective.
Yeah, well, Martin, exactly. In the three regions that I have to mention in my introduction, I mean, if you have risk inflation, crisis inflation, it is itself the justification to be involved in these areas here. Because I have always said, like in the Middle East, if the U.S. and the West got out of the Middle East, they would make their peace. It might be very turbulent, it might be very violent, but they would come to terms, okay? The same thing in Asia. But then when you have the Western powers, primarily the United States, that is a slippery slope not to make hard decisions, okay? And on top of it, I mean, you know, what Glenn was saying here, I mean, you know, the U.S. has complete dominance in Europe, but it's a pretty hollow prize, isn't it? I mean, if the Germans are going to be freezing in the winter, what kind of prize is that? Go ahead. No,
we need a Marshall Plan. We need Americans to fly in DC-3s and drop food aid over our cities in Europe. You know, that's where we're heading. I mean, the Germans now have to ration their hot water. Like they can only have two baths a week or something.
One of the richest countries in the world.
For the first time in 30 years, a trade deficit. You know, so this is worrying. And when you consider that Germany is the heart of the European Union, that's where all the power is. You know, I think when we look at the West in general, and we talk about the Middle East and Biden in Saudi Arabia the last couple of days and the fist punch, whatever you call it, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. There's a lot of BS out there, frankly. And this idea that America is going to stand by Israel and we're going to defeat Iran. I mean, for God's sake, what planet are you on, man? Who is going to take on Iran in their right mind? You know, and when the Israeli journalist pushed Biden, he just shrunk in his seat and he just kept saying, well, you know, as a last resort, you know, maybe he would. Well, probably would. Yeah, you know, nonsense, absolute nonsense. And the interesting thing is that we in the West have kept this fear mongering going in the Middle East for a long time now, because it's great business for us, it's great business for our arms countries, companies, you know, but it's fake, it's completely fake. And you only have to look very closely at the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran and how it's becoming slightly cooler. And, you know, these two neighbors are actually starting to open up back channel talks with each other. You know, they're both lining up to join BRICS. How can they be enemies if they're both going to be in a new trade order?
Well, it goes all back to what we've been saying here. It's one big grift here, okay? All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and in Marrakesh. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.